Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 81 for December 2nd, 2010, Leaf Lessons. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, here we are, Out of Line After Hours, and man, it is so good to be back in the studio. I feel like I've been gone forever. We took off last week because of the Thanksgiving holiday. We were in L.A. the week before that, and man, it's great to be back in the studio, and especially great to be back with the Auto Extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here.
Good to welcome a couple new sponsors.
Yeah, I mean, now we're starting to look like we really are something here.
Yeah.
It's great to welcome them on. Some of them are just sticking their toe in the water with us to see if they like what we've got to offer them, but it's really cool to have some big names in the business standing behind this show. And, of course, they know that this really is the best discussion and analysis of what's going on with cars, the people who make the cars, the industry that builds them. It's
if we do say so ourselves.
If we do say so ourselves. And joining us tonight, too, is Michael Robinette from IHS Automotive. Great having you here.
Thanks, John.
Great to have you back, because lots of things to talk about today, I guess. One of the things we could get into is sales. You know, we really just got all the numbers last night, and I was able to go through them this morning and all that. And not a great month, but not a bad month. I don't know. Peter, what do you make of the situation?
Exactly that. The upward trajectory continues. You know, now that this huge contraction has happened, I think the boom and bust cycles are over, and if we can just keep a slow, plodding upward slant to the chart, we'll be fine.
For at least the next 5 years. That's my prediction. In fact, I wrote a blog about that, not a blog today. I'm saying 5 years. That's what we've got. The next 5 years should be awesome. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think not only the OEMs, but the suppliers love stability. If you can turn the knob up to about 5 or 6 days a week and resource correctly and make sure you got all the stuff coming in, you make money at when you can turn the knob up and just let her go at that. If you've got premium overtime and premium freight, or you got to lay people off, that's how you don't make money, because apparently they pay you the same amount for components whether you make them on a Sunday or you make them on Monday afternoon.
As a supplier, if you're doing it Sunday, you're paying time.
You're
and a
paying
half.
Time and a half. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity, and you know, some of these OEMs are looking at extending capacity, third shifts, and looking at some other things. One of our analysts in China had just visited the FAW facility and said that they are working 13 straight days in a row, 24 hours a day at this plant, and they take one day off to clean the paint shop, and then they go back at it for another 13 days.
That's nice.
And I said, I can't believe that you can run a plant like that. We're going to run it into the ground, but
you will. I mean, you can run it on, as you know, on a short-term basis, but that's how they used to do things in this town. Sure. You just run it into the ground. You run it until it breaks.
And every 5 years, then they would have to put a tremendous amount of investment to reinvest in the facility, and then talk about how they're reinvesting, but they probably should have done a better job of maintaining it.
Right. So. But it does look like things are slowly getting better here. In fact, you know, now they're talking about manufacturing, which just a year and a half ago, you know, looked like it was flat on its back. That manufacturing, and not just here, but in Europe as well, is leading, you know, the older economies out of this recession.
And GM and Chrysler announced hiring of 1,000 people each. And, you know, people outside this area really don't appreciate that. But, you know, this area has been in a depression for, I would say, going on 4 years.
Oh, I'd say 10 at least.
Yeah. But so even though it was a minuscule amount, in the big scheme of things.
Well, you know, I think it's actually bigger than it sounds because, you know, the Center for Automotive Research has said for every automotive job, there's 8 other support jobs, whether it's, you know,
right.
supplier
well,
industry.
And out in the air out there, it doesn't sound like much to add 1,000 jobs, but it is a big deal.
The ripple effect starts to make it
it's
significant.
It's 1,000 people that aren't looking for work. It's all the neighborhoods and now have tax revenue. I mean, it just, the spillover is unbelievable.
And like I say, you know, they're just getting going. They're going to make gobs of money. But here's a question. Has Detroit really learned its lesson? And one of the reasons I ask that is this is the fourth resurgence I've seen in my career. And it seems to come almost every decade. You know, the first oil shock in 73 laid this industry flat. By 78, they could not build cars and trucks fast enough. The second oil shock was almost as bad as the downturn we yep. have gone through now. 80, 81, 82 were yep. Horrifically bad.
Oh, I've got bad memories of those.
And then 4 years later, we went on to record sales.
Yeah.
You know, the early 90s, we had the Gulf War. It wasn't that bad of a recession, but it was painful. And by the, you know, the middle of that decade, again, we were screaming forward. And every time we were down flat on our backs, we all said, we're never going to let this happen again. We've really learned our lesson this time. So that's, Peter, how do you see it? Has Detroit learned, really?
I think the fundamental difference, I was asked that on CNBC. I think the fundamental difference is that the bankruptcies have changed permanently, I believe, the mindset in these companies. I really do. And that's what I was talking about, the boom and bust days. You know, right about now in the old days, Detroit would be cranking it up like, okay, here we go. We're gonna make big money and big bonuses. And yeah, there's none of that. The bankruptcies permanently changed the mentality of this town. But saying that, I still think there's some, you know, a couple of these executives at these companies could fall off the wagon at any minute and lose their focus. And to me, that's the one thing that they cannot do. They have to stay focused on
that. I think Peter's right, especially the labor contract change. I mean, that to go in and make such massive changes to the labor contract, you know, it's something that we've been needing to go through this car wash for 30 or 40 years, and we finally went through it. And I don't think that a lot of these guys are going to want to go through it again. But then again, you know, in 15 years, it's going to be a whole other slate of executives that are going to have to learn their lesson all over again. So I'm going to be retired by then. I know that for a fact. So.
Well, you know, you raise one of the issues that it's one of my litmus tests as to whether this town has really learned the lesson. And if the UAW goes to strike Ford to force it to give up so many of the concessions that made it competitive,
then all bets are off.
Then all bets are off. Exactly right.
If that old school stuff starts happening again, that'll be.
And, you know, as I say, it's easy to predict Ford's going to be the target because the bankruptcy deal legally prohibits the union from striking Chrysler or GM.
Or GM, yeah.
Which it owns stock in, by the way. So
it would be biting its own hand. I agree. And I know that, you know, certainly the Ford executives, you hear them ask this all the time. Hey, what's going to happen? Oh, we have wonderful relationships. We think we're going to be able to work through it. And I really do think they think that. But you hope that the membership saw what happened at Chrysler and what happened at GM and say to themselves, maybe we should, you know, pedal back a little bit. And
Michael, it's not happening.
I know.
You look at the Orion Township plant. You know, they want to bring in the Aveo there to build. And they've told the union and the International, you know, which is
Solidarity.
Sort of the mothership,
yep.
has said, yeah, we'll go along with this deal where 40% of the workers have to come in at the new wage rate.
Mm-hmm.
And they went ballistic. They're trying to protest it. And then GM was trying to sell off a stamping plant in Indiana.
In Indianapolis, yeah.
And they told them to shove it. They weren't going to give up concessions. Why? Because most of those workers can transfer out.
Or retire. Yeah.
But what about, you know, new people coming into the business? yeah, $14.50 an hour isn't all that great. With benefits, you're probably up to $20 an hour. There's a lot of people who would love to step in and earn that kind of a living right now.
And the stability of it. I think that's the other thing that we had talked about, is that the industry's moving up, and I do believe that the structure of the industry has changed enough that it will be a lot more stable. Are we going to have gyrations? Yes. To the extent that we just saw, it would have to, an extraneous event would have to really drive that. I don't think that someone's going to get as bad as what we saw. I say that, maybe I'll eat my words one day, but I still, you know, we just talked about this at a briefing we had. We talked about the fact that scale is still critical. Flexibility is very critical. All these guys have finally gone global. They finally got the memo. speed to market. The other thing is that this convergence of labor, not so much labor, but emission standards and fuel economy standards and safety, everybody's using global platforms. Well, you can't go off kilter from the rest of the world. So if your vehicle's on a 6-year cycle, guess what? If you wanted to be on a 7 or 8 to elongate the amortization schedule, can't do it. You're going to have to revise every 6 years. So that's a great opportunity for both the OEMs and the suppliers to get new technology into their vehicles more quickly.
Another thing I think that we got to be on the lookout for, and I don't know how you change this one, and that's our short-term focus, in that in the United States, by law, you have to report your earnings every 3 months. In other words, you got to close the books every 3 months. Everybody's got to make sure they're on budget. And so how do you start looking down, addressing issues that can't be dealt with for 5 years or 10 years if you got to close the books every 3 months? I don't know how you deal with that.
Well, this is the land of short-term thinking. That's the way this business has been run. You're only as good as your last, you know, quarter.
And unfortunately, the dealers think even shorter than that.
Yeah, 30 days.
How many vehicles did you sell this week, last week, and am I going to make my quota for the month kind of thing?
Well, yeah, there's goodness in that you've got to really be focusing on your business, making sure it's delivering. There's a discipline that drives that can be good. But I don't know, how do you get the balance to look at things in the long term? That should be a board-level mandate on management. But how do you get management, or even at a board level, to start thinking in those terms and drive it into the process of running the company?
Well, you see it in these companies now. You're seeing it now. They're taking the longer view. They're making the hard choices, the choices they have to make to be in business 6-7 years from now. Whereas, yeah, this business is dominated by, you know, you get a good quarter, everybody's high-fiving in the halls, and it's like, wow, this is great, you know. But I do think those days are over. I mean, they just are.
Or you can look at it. I mean, I know we talked about Chrysler before the show, but if you think about Chrysler 3 or 4 years ago, where they really cheaped out in interiors and tried to have cost targets below the vehicles that they were replacing, which were unbelievably unrealistic, and someone learned a lesson. You know what? Customers want soft touch. They want better materials. They want better functionality in their vehicles. We got to give it to them, or else they're not going to buy them. So it gets to a point where, yeah, we're going to save money by putting a lot of plastic in the vehicles, but at some point, somebody finally realized, and I agree. I think it's now the total value equation. What, you know, what's the total profitability once we put this investment in?
Yeah. Well, what changed really was getting rid of the legacy costs, because, you know, when you had a push model where you just had to build stuff and then get into the incentives, yep, and you can't get it in pricing, so you take the cost out of the car. Well, we've been down that road before. But that's just my fear. I say this is the fourth collapse. I've seen this industry come roaring back 3 times. We're in the process of it roaring back. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, I just hope we don't make the same mistakes again.
Yeah, I guess to me, the overriding difference is the global nature of the business now. I mean, that has finally resonated throughout the domestic automobile industry as we look at it today. And that component was missing before.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Yeah,
I agree.
So that has
fundamentally changed.
Fundamentally
changed. I would agree with you on that.
I mean, and, you know, to me, you're absolutely right, though, mentioning the UAW. That's the wild card. Now, though, I was encouraged when you went on that trade mission and Bob King was on there. And the one anecdote you related about, you know, when you get over to Italy and look at the way the Fiat is and all the unions, like there's, what, 2 or 3 overall unions? And then
4.
And then there's 4 unions, and then there's like a whole
bunch of locals.
And Bob King said, how they get anything done. I mean, so he's more so than any other UAW leader is forced to have the global perspective. Mm-hmm. Absolutely forced. It's not a CAW thing. It's not a UAW thing. Just here, you are forced to look at the big picture. And if you don't, you do so at your peril. Yeah. That's going to be a bad.
Lose your job.
There's no more regional car industry anymore. It really is global. Like, for instance, you mentioned the globalization. If you look at a vehicle like Cruise, that vehicle and its platform was designed with a lot of protections in mind. What do the Europeans want? What do the Americans mm-hmm. need? What do the Chinese need? And they designed it all in. And you can't go backwards and say, well, the Americans want to make it 6 inches wider. No, you don't understand. It isn't going to happen. Here's your box. You find what kind of package you want in this box.
And you know, look at Ford with Fiesta and especially with the Focus that's coming.
Right.
I mean, you are talking a vehicle that's truly global around the world. And, you know, it's just fundamentally changed.
Well, this is a perfect segue to talk about one of our sponsors right now, the Chevrolet Cruze. And this is really the first global car that Chevrolet's offered, isn't it?
Yeah, because it really Malibu, which was off of Epsilon. Epsilon wanted to be a global platform, but really wasn't a global platform. So actually,
even if the platform had been the same, there were all different variants built off it. The Cruze is pretty much the Cruze, right?
Yeah.
Anywhere in the world.
Cruze in China, Cruze in Europe, Cruze here is basically fairly close. The powertrain is slightly different, but for the most part, it's basically the same car.
Yeah. And then that gives you the scale, i.e., sell so many of them that now you can put decent materials in the thing because you can easily pay for it.
And amortize it over many more vehicles and have a strong five or six year cycle on the vehicle so the suppliers are more engaged in the vehicle and also in the replacement as well.
One thing I liked in the car was the interior, and it was interesting because at first I got in and I thought, yeah, this is a nice looking car, but the more I drove the car, the more I liked it. It's pretty comfortable.
Yeah, I had one recently, too, for a week. And, you know, I wasn't really too appreciative of the design.
Mm-hmm.
I think but once you drive it, it's very impressive. And dynamically, it's impressive, the feel. To me, you know, for me, it's all about the feel behind the wheel. And it's definitely the first mainstream Chevrolet that feels competitive mm-hmm. and the way it should be. And even the design sort of grew on me. However, I think GM and Chevrolet have their work cut out when the Focus hits. You know, so that'll
be. Well, it's turning into a bloodbath out there. You know,
yeah.
If you look at the sales numbers, it was real interesting to me to see. You know, usually it's been Camry, Accord, maybe Fusion. Malibu's been in there this month. Man, Altima jumped over everybody but Camry.
Yep.
And Altima's had, you know, it's been pretty good. But, man, they really did a number in that segment this time. And the Sonata, which had been, you know, strong, was still good, but it had gone, you know, been passed by a few. And so there's a lot of jockeying in that segment right now.
Sonata, interestingly enough, is running into some supply problems because, you know, they've integrated the Elantra into that facility. So they have to make room for another vehicle. And it's like, hey, I'm selling well. Well, we got another one coming in. And, you know, and then they can't balance well enough out of Korea. And I don't think they really want to. The Juan's pretty expensive these days compared to when the program first started. So it's not like you're taping money to every hood, but they would rather build them in Alabama.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about the Sonata later in the program because they're one of the sponsors too. And by the way, if you want anything more on the Cruze, go to Chevrolet.com/Cruze. If you can't remember the URL, just go to the Autoline website, click on their logo. That'll take you there.
There's some interesting stuff in those sales numbers that we were talking. How hot the Panamera is for Porsche.
Panamera. I had no idea it is the best-selling car Porsche has. Easily outsells the 911. The Cayenne slightly outsells the Panamera, but I had no idea that car would sell as well as it's doing.
Yeah, I didn't either.
They're doing almost 1,000 a month, which in any other car you'd go, boy, that's not very successful. But in the price point Porsche plays in, that's very impressive.
Yes, very.
I was in Toronto about 8 or 9 months ago, and one passed me on the 401, and my sons were in the car, and, oh, my God, Dad, is that a pickup? Yes, yes, let's catch up to it. So I'm stepping on my car, and, of course, he's blowing past me. But that car has such a presence. It's such a monster, but such a presence on the road. It really does.
Yeah, I still don't care for the design.
The
three-quarter view. And the profile is dreadful, but I'll tell you, when I drove it, it was just like, oh, boy.
Yeah,
they
now
did
I get it.
They did it again.
Then we were talking to the Acura ZDX, totally at the opposite end of the scale. It's scary how that's not selling. They sold, what did I tell you, Michael, 156?
Yeah, 150. I mean, you may as well shut the assembly line down. It doesn't even, I mean, you could produce that vehicle for a couple of hours once a month, and that would basically, and that's a sad reality.
It is.
That
really is. It really is. It's amazing.
Acura needs to press the reset button in a hurry, or they literally could be out of business in this country. They have got to get their stuff together. And I don't know how they're going to do that. But the other thing we were talking about is the reality of the hybrid sales. And you pulled out some numbers that were just
staggering. Oh, it's
unbelievable.
They don't sell. I mean, I think you mentioned in your column this week that it's, what, 3 years in a row now or something like that, that
yeah.
Hybrid sales have declined.
And what did you say, the LS600H or whatever?
Oh, yeah, let me get these numbers up because it's just eye-opening. When you see these things, that the Lexus LS600, they sold 13 hybrids last month. They sold 9 the month before.
And they were probably all in California.
And they probably were. They probably were. But, you know, the point is that with the exception of the Prius, which continues to sell well, they did over 10,000 units. That's serious selling. Every other hybrid, I can guarantee you, is losing money for whichever manufacturer is building it. It's just not working from a sales standpoint.
It's a scary proposition. But if fuel prices do rise, you'll start to see people at least start to look at trading off and what the possibilities are. But it ebbs and flows. But I
agree. But even so, even when it flows...
Well, speaking of
overall numbers are not big.
Speaking of political statements masquerading as cars, boy, GM's just got a tremendous spike from the Volt in the last 3 weeks. Just
well, the other thing that helped too is Motor Trend Car of the Year,
yeah.
Automobile Car of the Year, Green Car Journal Car of the Year, and
well, that doesn't mean we're going to be forced to do Autoline After Hours awards because, you know.
I'm thinking Top Gear here. You know, they have their annual awards.
Oh, let's not go into the American version of Top Gear. Boy, talk about augering it into the ground.
I saw the first one, and I didn't think it was bad. And I thought if it shows progress from here, they could be all right. But I've only seen the first one. I've got the other one recorded. I just haven't watched.
Well, you know. A buddy of mine pointed out to me, well, we've got all these British TV programs that translate quite well to the U.S. And I said, yeah, but this is different. That particular British program was a singular.
Yeah.
It had an American following that went beyond the usual PBS crowd,
yeah.
Masterpiece Theater kind of stuff.
But it's also the personalities.
Yeah,
those three guys mesh together so well. They're so different, but yet they mesh together so well.
You can't recreate that.
Well, remember, they've been at it for years.
Yeah.
And I'd love to go back and watch the first few episodes of that show and measure it against the first few episodes of the American
one. But to think, you know, and no, I'm not running down this American program, but to think you're going to have that kind of chemistry.
No.
You just
it's forced.
Yeah, you can't flip the switch and just have it be that. It's unfortunate, but it's the reality.
There's not a lot of car shows, and no offense, John, but not a lot of car shows that I can sit down with my sons and that they're absolutely intrigued with. And the one when those three guys went through the Bolivian forest to get to the ocean, and then the other one where they found that road that Ceausescu built in the Romanian mountains, they loved both those episodes. They keep wanting to watch that over and over and over again.
My absolute favorite one was the one, I think it was the Aston Martin. B12, and he talked about if this could be the last gasp of the supercar, and boy, that was just magnificant. So tell us about your political statement that you were driving.
Oh, I was driving the political statement that goes by the name of Nissan Leaf, and it was interesting. I got to say, I really do like the Leaf. It's comfortable. It's got a decent range. You know, 100 miles should satisfy most everybody.
I should pause briefly. Hello, Simon. We know you're listening.
Right. But what I found was going on a media drive, you know, where they bring all us journalists in for the thing, and driving electric cars, whether the Leaf or the Volt, and then living with it at home.
Two different
experiences. And what the first thing I found out is, if all you have is a 110-volt outlet, you don't want an electric car. I'll tell you right now.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah. 20 hours to recharge a Leaf.
So you can only drive it every other day, basically.
Ouch.
So, I mean,
you need two of them.
One for every other day. You get into what I call a charging deficit, because there's just not enough hours in the day where you can have it parked to get it recharged. So the next day, you don't have a 100-mile range. You know, you have, let's say, an 80 range, and then the next day, you know, 60. Wow. And so to your point, you know, at some point in the week, you got to say, sorry, can't come to work today. I got to leave the Leaf plugged in. Now, that's at 110. If you get to 220, it cuts the recharge time by less than half.
Okay.
So that should be good enough. And if you can charge at work,
that's golden.
Now you're golden.
Yeah.
Okay. But first thing I learned is, if you got 110, forget it. You do not want an electric car. Other thing that I learned is they give you this portable plug. It's like an extension cord with this box of electronics in it. So I get out there, I plug it into an outlet. In fact, it's by my front door at the house. It's where I plug in the Christmas tree lights. So I plug in the Christmas tree lights. They come on. Okay, it's got juice. Plug it in. Plug it into the car. And it makes this little beep. And I go and look inside the car, and this little pictograph of a plug comes up on the instrument panel, even though the car is turned off. So I think, bingo, I'm good to go. It's charging. I was wrong. Nothing charged. Not one electron went into the batteries. Because it's a big, fat plug they give you. And the outlet that I tried to put it in, it didn't quite seat all the way. I thought it was, but it wasn't. And then it beeped when I plugged in, and this little pictograph appears. So I figure I'm good to go. No. You've got to check these lights on the box that's on the cable. Then there's these other lights on the dashboard. Okay. The next day, it's charging. But again, I've gone on this long trip.
And now you're charging deficit issue.
Now I'm into my charging deficit. There are not enough hours to charge the thing up for me to be able to, you know, had enough to get back here to work, but I wouldn't have been able to go anywhere else. Then the other thing is, really cool feature, you can set the temperature that you want in the car. So I'm thinking, it's cold, as you guys know here. We're into winter. So I thought, cool, I'm going to set the temperature to be 74 degrees at 7 a.m. So, you know, the first night I get out there, or first morning I get out there, it hasn't charged at all. I get in the car, it's freezing cold. Then I find out, okay, I'm an idiot. I didn't do these things right. I move the plug down to the next outlet, plugs in fine. So the second night, everything charges. No problem at all. But I get out there in the morning, still freezing cold in the car. The stupid auto temperature thing never came on. So I called Nissan. I go, what's going on here? Oh, we'll send somebody over. Well, I'll come over and we'll check it all out. And nope, you said it right. Everything's right here. We can't figure out why this thing didn't come on. And so there's another thing I learned is, just because it all looks like you've got everything set up perfectly, maybe it's not going to work. Then the other thing that I noticed is Nissan's done this cool thing where you can pull up this one screen that shows you everything. You turn on the radio, you can see how it affects the battery life. You put on not just the headlights. If you put on the brights, you can see how you're using more electricity. So you can really monitor.
Like when they were trying to get those guys back from Apollo 13. You know, oh, you're using too much voltage. Oh, no, you're going to have to do it in a different sequence. So,
but anyway, what I find is, because it didn't charge up, and I had a business lunch I had to go to, 30 miles one way. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, am I going to get back? I mean, here's the range anxiety thing. So I turn on the heater because, again, God damn it, it's cold. And as soon as you turn on the heater, boom, your driving range drops by at least 10 miles. At least 10 miles.
Oh, man.
So I warmed up my toes and turned off the heat, and, you know, then the range goes back up. So it's funny. It's like it's almost like going back to the early days of the automobile. You know, if you want an electric car, you should have a big overcoat, you know, lined, and, you know, scarf and gloves, and that's how you get your range. But I got to tell you, I love the experience. I really did enjoy it. It was such a unique change from everything that I go through.
Decent torque and launch and all that.
Oh, yeah.
How about degradation of the battery life with the cold weather?
You know, because I was never able to fully charge it up, I couldn't really get a good reference point.
I bet you it's going to be a real-world issue, though.
Yeah. I'm saying this stuff. I feel like an idiot talking about it, but, you know, I'm not the only idiot out there. Other people are going to go through this.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. It's quite a bet. It's like we were saying earlier, Goen has not basically done the hybrid strategy and then kind of morphed into this full electric strategy. He skipped right over.
Right.
And the other guys, the Fords of the world, the GMs, have done more of this sort of graduated strategy to kind of learn their lesson along the way.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, like we say, you know, if somebody starts shooting missiles into oil tankers, Carlos Ghosn's going to look like a genius. And if gas doesn't go a whole lot higher than it is right now, I think they're going to have a hard time with these things, real hard time. And I keep making the point, you know, what's a battery pack in an electric car like the Leaf right now? $13,000 to $15,000.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. The engine guys keep telling me, just let me put $1,000 more in my engine. Man, what I can do with that. What can I do?
ICEs have a long way to go.
Right.
And, yeah, if you put some more cost into we're going to be driving ICEs for another 40, 50 years.
Well, look at this market. Our test cycle. We had a briefing today where we talked about this. Our test cycle, our powertrain guy was explaining this to everybody. Our test cycle, basically the longest stop in the U.S. test cycle is 25 seconds. So, you know, a lot of OEMs are saying, well, why on earth would I want to put start-stop on a vehicle in the U.S.? Because if you're only stopping for 25 seconds, for the extra cost, I'm not going to get the bang for the buck. For the EPA, right.
Drive cycle.
If you change the drive cycle, more real world where apparently you are at a light for 45 seconds to a minute and a half sometimes, hey, you really can save some energy by shutting the engine down and having a start-stop system.
Right.
But that's not real world.
Yeah, I know, but I think start-stop's going to happen here anyway. I think competitive pressures will drive it, even if the EPA doesn't recognize it. And I bet they will.
The Panamera I drove was fine. It just didn't bother me at all, stop-start.
But one of the problems is that if you have an automatic transmission, you're going to have electric pump to keep the pressure up, because if you take your foot off the brake, the engine's going to have to start up to build the pressure up again in the automatic transmission so you can take off. That's why DCTs and those types of transmissions are so much better for start-stop.
Right. But, you know, the EPA should tweak its...
You would hope.
Well, they're not going to tweak the test standard just because that would screw up every automaker in the world just about, but they could add another fudge factor.
Mm-hmm.
To what they label the car at if you have stop-start, because real world, like you're saying,
you're saving 5-7% sometimes.
Sure.
So that's a lot of fuel if you think about
it.
It
sure is. It sure is. Hey, speaking of which, we should get to one of our other sponsors, because actually this ties in perfectly. And we're talking about Dow Beta Foam, which is a structural foam. You know, automakers will often put foam in a car as a sound deadener, and this also does that. But structural foam is a way that you can add strength to a vehicle at specific points. You just shoot it right into it, and it can really help in terms of lightening a car, which gets you to better fuel economy.
I think you're going to find that there's still a lot of cost-benefit equations being worked out. And is magnesium going to work here? Is aluminum going to work here? Is high-strength steel going to work here? So, you know, new material ideas are always being welcomed by the OEMs these days. I think they're thinking out of the box these days in terms of, I know carbon fiber with BMW and the Megacity project, that is huge for them.
Right.
It's a hell of a gamble, but, you know, they're not devoting a lot of resources towards it, so it's interesting to see how it'll work out.
Right.
My favorite story from the early development of 5 mile-an-hour bumpers was the guy who came up with filling the bumpers with unpopped popcorn and then heating the bumper and having the popcorn pop inside to add crushability.
Oh, my gosh.
I thought that was genius.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
Sort of like structural foam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except by Orville Redenbacher.
Yeah. Or you can salt and butter it, and it doesn't taste half bad.
Right. You know, I thought that was clever.
I think there's going to be a lot of clever ideas. And, you know, if you think back to the second oil shock that we talked about earlier, the late, 1979, in the early 80s, there was all kinds of real impetus to come up with lightweight structures. And I remember General Motors at one point was offering anybody on a product team all-expense-paid trip with you and your spouse to go to Chicago, New York, some nice city, if you could take a pound out of whatever component you were working on. If you figured out how to take out a pound, boom, you got a nice all-expenses-paid little mini vacation with your spouse.
I mean, a lot of people don't think about this, but you take weight out of one component, especially something that's a little bit higher in the vehicle, you can reduce the complexity or the weight that has to be supported by your suspension, which means you have weight savings in other areas of the vehicle. It's not just in one area, it's other areas as well.
It compounds. Yep. Exactly. I still think one thing that is a big opportunity is glass.
Glass is
very heavy.
Yes.
And I know there's been all kinds of, push to go with polycarbonate glass, but I guess the problem is glass, besides being heavy, is a great way of blocking noise. And you go with polycarbonate, and the car is just that much loud. Not the car itself, but it lets in so much more noise.
That's why the Citroën C4 Coupe is not going to be replaced. They're replacing it with basically like a DS4 type of derivative. It's going to be more of a sedan. But that vehicle had glass basically from the front of the A-post all the way back to the end, through the entire roof. But it was heavy as heck. And that was one of the big problems that they had with that vehicle.
Well, designers would love to be able to do several things. Mold glass far more than what you can do right now and change the color. And I know there was a push to get, all glass today has a green tint to it. There was a real push at one point to go to blue tinted glass, but it never seemed to go anywhere. I just haven't seen it. I know the designers a few years back, 5, 6, 7 years ago, were really talking about it, but just it never came to happen.
Are we ready to flip the switch?
I think we're ready to flip the switch, but, this is probably, before we get into rapid fire, a good time to go back to the Sonata and talk about what is now the sixth generation redesign of the Sonata. I had no idea, six generations. I didn't realize it had been around that long.
Well, five of them were so forgettable.
and the first one...
Sorry, Hyundai, but that's reality.
The first one, growing up in Canada, that was Canada's favorite roadside monument.
The Sonata?
Yeah.
I thought it was the pony.
Well, both of them were really horrid vehicles, unfortunately.
But man, they got it right this time.
Yeah, they did.
Learned a lot of lessons. It's a fantastic vehicle. It really is.
It really is. And, they've got the turbo version now. They've got a hybrid version. They're really starting to extend the model line a little bit. And I think the only problem with the car is they just can't build enough of them. They don't have the manufacturing capacity.
It's a nice problem to have.
Right.
It, but you're right. And their Korean facility, they've extended it. Even Korean sales are actually not that strong these days, so they are exporting more of them.
And they've added the new Elantra.
Right. So Alabama, and 40 miles per gallon with no extra cost in the vehicle. If fuel prices do rise, which we think that they may, that thing, people are going to run a path to their door. So looks
cool.
Good, too.
Yeah, it really does. It really does look good. And, the new Elantra is almost like, the little brother to the car. It's not the exact same thing.
They have to be careful with that, though.
They do have to. because you don't want everything looking exactly the same.
No.
I was in Korea and saw the K7, the Kia K7. It looks fantastic. It looks better than most of the Hyundai products.
What's the K7?
It's basically the slightly larger version of the Sonata, so that would be the K5. Mm-hmm. Then there's a larger version. It's not necessarily off Genesis.
But not
it's,
a Zera?
It's basically an Azera type of vehicle in terms of size.
Uh-huh.
So think of it sort of Maxima in size.
Oh, interesting.
It looks fantastic.
Oh, really?
Really good. Almost like a real replacement for a Mahdi. And I almost hate to say that word on this program. But
Yeah, a lot of people may not remember a Mahdi.
It was very unmemorable. So.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's go to rapid fire. Ben, I think it's time to pull up that graphic. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Jeff W. wants to know, how well does the 2011 Dodge Journey stand up to the 2011 Ford Edge? Ooh, good question. The Edge is selling fantastic. They did 10,000 plus last month. Yeah. Wow, I had no idea.
What an example of a great tweaking of a design.
Both of them, really. Yeah. Journey and Edge.
Yeah.
I'd give the nod to the Edge. The Journey's a nice vehicle. But again, Ford is just ahead of everybody right now when it comes to in-car electronics. Sync, my Ford Touch. And I got to tell you, too, that instrument panel on the Edge, I just love the way the whole thing looks. Kudos to Ford.
I would agree. I think that, you know, they've improved the Journey a lot with this latest redesign. Well, it's what we would call a moderate in the business, and actually the Edge is really a moderate. But you're right that the navigation, that whole MyTech system it really is top shelf.
Okay, Glenn asks, why doesn't Hyundai Kia put the direct ignition motor into the Sportage and Tucson? More power and better MPG. My guess is it will happen at some point. I think everybody's holding back. They don't need direct injection instantly right now to meet CAFE standards, but
it is more costly.
It is.
They have to engineer those engines in a lot of those vehicles as well.
It is more costly, but I'd invest in it now because you're going to need it.
You're going to need it at some point.
Okay, so let's see here. Mud Monster wants to know, how many A3s have they sold this month? Do you know that off the top of your head at all?
I don't.
Okay.
No, but I happen to really like that vehicle.
They sold 788 of them, which isn't a bad number. That puts it, looks like the third best-selling Audi passenger car, if I'm reading these numbers right. So that's not too bad.
Or five times the RDX.
Yeah. Right. J.D. Clough says, I find the Cruze has the worst, most uncomfortable seats GM has ever put out there. What are your opinions, fellows? I thought they were comfortable.
I didn't have a problem with seats. So.
It depends on your size,
yeah.
I think. You know, I think it depends on the size of the person, but I found them. In fact, it was by the end of the week that I really started to notice how comfortable I thought the car was, including the seats.
Yeah.
Okay, Jeff W. says, is it just me or is GM start marketing the Malibu? It's a shame because it's a good car. You know, he might have something there.
Well, they have so much on their plate right now.
They do.
They're doing divisional ads for Chevrolet. They're doing launch ads for Volt. They're doing continuous ads for Cruze. So, yeah, Malibu has got.
And they haven't had to put too much advertising for Equinox because it's selling so well. So
yeah.
They probably have dialed that back, though.
And Malibu is
selling really well.
It's a nice vehicle.
Yeah, it is a tremendous vehicle. But so Malibu's, it's gotten lost in the shuffle.
It's gotten lost. In fact, Impala, I think, if I read the numbers right, outsold it last month. So, Scott in Cleveland, how much truth is there in your opinion to the latest rumor that the G8 will be repackaged into a Chevrolet? We've heard this rumor many times, but it's making another round.
Hey, Scott in Cleveland, Scotty. There's a hot Chevrolet coming, and it'll be based on the underpinnings of the big rear-wheel drive Australian car. I mean, that's coming. It's coming.
Yeah, it is coming. Miss Motormouth, all right, Michelle, says, Rick Krantz at Automotive News uses Corvette sales as a barometer for the overall economy. Does the 9.7% year-to-date Corvette sales drop really reflect the American economy?
No. It reflects the fact that Chevrolet delayed, because of this bankruptcy, the sequence, the model sequence of the Corvette got all screwed up. And that's all that reflects.
Yeah.
They're looking at, what, late 12 now, early 13?
Oh, 14, isn't it?
It's later now?
For the C7?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought they were going to move it up because they're already working on the C8.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So. George from Brooklyn says, what does the panel think of the Porsche Cayenne, which is the baby Cayenne?
Well, it's their version of the Q5, and I'm sure... You know, I guess I'm done talking about Porsche because, I could.
They're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, they're going to do it anyway. Will it be more sporty than the Q5? Yes. Will it be, you know, it may be the only crossover thingy that I would actually even think about driving on a regular basis. But I'm sure it'll be good. Yeah. Do I like it? No. Do I like Porsche making trucks? No. Whatever.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Jay Cujo says, should Toyota be worried about their sales number? The past few months, they've been negative, while pretty much everyone else has been positive.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I would say that they should be concerned. You know, there is some newer product coming, but it can't come quick enough. And I think that they really need a strong vehicle to let people forget about what's occurred over the last couple of years.
Yeah, they've got a double whammy. They've got a dearth of new product, and they've got this image thing. And I got to tell you, this image thing is going to linger for a long time to come.
Right. Well, you know, and then they just had another self-inflicted, recall for the Prius. I say self-inflicted because it's not an official recall. They just decided to step forward and do it, but, you know, they probably would have.
It was better than having the government tell them to do it. Let's put it that way.
Joseph says, I was reading the minivan comparison in the new Motor Trend and kept thinking that the Transit Connect could compete with the minivans in a lot of ways. Is there any chance Ford will produce a version of the Transit Connect modified to be kind of a PT Cruiser, Honda Element type vehicle?
Well, the next generation Transit Connect is quite handsome. The current one is a bit quirky, as they say. The next one's actually a handsome vehicle, but it's never going to be a minivan type.
No, Ford's got the Grand C-Max, which they're going to be building here next year.
Which is sensational.
Which is quite nice.
Very nice.
Quite nice. And interestingly, if you want to know what it's like, go look at a Mazda 5.
Yes.
But don't look at the styling. The Ford version's different, but it's essentially the same footprint, the same vehicle. Yeah. And it's interesting. If you go back, it's almost the same size, more or less, as the Chrysler.
The original
T115 minivan.
And it's funny. Over time, Chrysler found that they were doing almost 80% long and 20% short. So that's one of the reasons why they get rid of the short minivan.
Phil in Burlington says, it's great to see a Canadian on your program. The first of many, I hope.
Can we tell him what kind of beer we're drinking? Beer you can only get in Canada, Upper Canada Lager and Sleem and Cream Ale.
Yeah. So. But you're an American, too, now.
I'm both two nationalities now, U.S.
You became a U.S. citizen.
Yes. Yes.
Congratulations. We love having you as part of us, too.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And you're going to coach a hockey game when you leave here, right?
Yes. Yeah, so he hasn't lost his Canadian roots at all.
Definitely not.
And, in fact, we were going to have Sandy Monroe here tonight, but he fell ill. That's why we asked you to join us. We would have asked you anyway.
Oh,
but,
thanks.
But Sandy's another Canadian who's become an American citizen.
This town is full of them.
They're taking over. Steve says, so how long do you think gas is going to stay at these prices, given the fact that no new oil refineries are made?
You know, I just absolutely am convinced we're going to have another gas spike. And, you know, I don't think we can continue to count on this being the way. I mean, you're kidding yourself if you think gas is going to stay at this level. I just think.
Especially as the global economy starts to heat up more, there'll be more use for gas, more need for gas. And he's right about the refinery issue. That is still a pretty big issue in the U.S., so that's going to be another issue that has to be dealt with. I agree. It's one of the reasons why I continue to buy gas stocks, because they're going to continue to go up. So.
Hey, Ben, I see we've got some phone calls here. Why don't we bring in a phone call right now?
My name is John Dunlap. I'm calling from southern Missouri in the Ozarks.
All right.
And I have a question. Are they going to discuss how all these EVs are going to screw up the power supply in the United States? I'm really interested in watching that one. Now, a hybrid for it making its own, I can see how that get along just fine, but not a pure electric vehicle.
Great question. And here's why. A couple of years back, what the automakers were saying is that, oh, no problem, we can have millions of cars plugging in and it's not going to affect the grid. And then literally just in the last week or so, they went, well, there could be some problems, actually. And very interestingly, in fact, it was some of the Volt people talking about this, of all things, that especially when you get to what they call the level three chargers, mm-hmm. these 480-volt things that are like defibrillators, they charge the car real fast.
That's not good.
They suck up like 50,000 watts at a time, and that is a load on the grid. So my guess is if this is sort of scattered around, it's not going to be that bad. But I think in certain communities, just look at where Priuses are selling right now. That's where the Leaf and the Volt are going to sell heavily. I think those regions, those communities, could definitely run into grid problems.
And also, a lot of these OEMs were hoping that they were going to be recharged at 2 in the morning. And a lot of times, it's not happening. So.
Well, the other thing, too, though, is, look, we already have brownouts in some cities in the summertime when everyone's running their AC. So now you're going to start plugging in electric cars. There blows the theory of, oh, you can just do it at night. Yeah, in most places, most of the time, you can do it at night. But
not everywhere.
If you start causing problems, people aren't going to care if it's only a few times a year.
Oh, Joe plugged his car in. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Right. Let's go burn his garage down. Let's bring in another one here, Ben.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question for Peter this week is, do you think it hurts Cadillacs, or GM's trying to push Cadillac into the premium area by not really having any unique powertrains? I mean, most of the engines and the transmissions they share with other mainstream GM products, or are some unique powertrains coming down the pipe somewhere? Thanks.
I think when they do the Uber Cadillac, the super luxury car, that better have something that you can't get in any other GM vehicle.
But I think just about everything else is going to be a variant off of a basically a global engine fit.
Right.
The days of Cadillac just having its very own engine for its mass production vehicle, those days are finished.
Yeah.
Gets back to your point about scale. You've got to have
You can't. You can't afford to have a block just for 50,000 or 60,000 cars. It's just not going to work anymore.
People will say, well, how can BMW can do it? How can Mercedes? Well, because they sell globally. They sell a million units. Cadillac's not there. It's damn near impossible for Cadillac.
If you look at BMW, you know, i6s, they're not bending sixes last time I looked, but different variants of that different i6. Mm-hmm. Some are bigger, some are smaller, but basically it's the same thought pattern.
Now, you know, Cadillac could go the Bugatti route and do a, you know, put two engines together or something if they want to play that way. But that 130,000 Cadillac better be special.
It better be. And, you know, they've got this fantastic engine facility just down the road here in Wixom, where they hand-build the Corvette engines and the like. So you hand-build some Cadillac ones.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Hey, John, this is Rick from San Diego. Hey, do you think one of your new sponsors, the Chevy Cruze, is going to be GM's or Chevy's answer to the Corolla, Civics, and Focuses of the world, and hopefully get Chevrolet established with the Cruze and the Malibu to battle the Corollas and Camrys and Civics and Accords and Fusions and Focuses and Fusions of the world? Your thoughts. Thanks.
Good question. I want to look up what were the Corolla at, or Corolla sales. I don't think were all that good last month.
Well, the Cruze is an excellent car. So whether Camry people look at it or Corolla people look at it, if they give it a chance, then Chevy's going to do well with it.
Yeah, and you almost can't help but improve upon Cobalt. So
yeah.
Big step forward. Look, it's still early in the Cruze launch. Sales are growing very quickly. I think it absolutely can knock off Corolla. I think it could do it maybe even in the next month or two. Mm-hmm. Civic, boy, that's a tough one. Civic is
Civic has a revision next year too.
Uh-huh.
It's coming.
So, and when you ask, is it competitive? It's all going to depend. If you're a real enthusiast, you're probably going to want something like the Civic. If you're just looking for a comfortable family commuter kind of car, the Cruze is going to be hard to beat.
Yeah.
And like I said, Corolla has really slipped badly lately.
That car is aging non-gracefully. It really is, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Okay, Ben, let's bring in another one.
This is Jim from Sioux Falls. I have a question for Mike. I saw on MSN that the Chevy Aveo sold over 200,000 units in Asia. Yet in this country, it gets absolutely trashed by Consumer Reports. And if it's true that the automakers cannot make a car for this market versus the Asian market, why would a company like Chevrolet even bring the Aveo here when it just gives them a bad name and a bad reputation? Just wondering about that.
Well, speaking of names, they're changing the name of the Aveo.
Oh, really?
Here, yes.
Oh, interesting.
Well, I think what's interesting is the Aveo actually does well in markets where B cars, we call that a B car, do well. Europe, some parts of where gasoline is expensive, and they have a gas tax that drive people to make different decisions for their transportation. I think you have to give it time. Aveo actually is a very nice offering within a lot of B segment offerings, and there'll be more of them coming in the future too. So
and the
competition's
new one's,
not going to go away.
Quite good.
It's a very nice vehicle. I think B cars at this fuel price level are still a pretty tough sell in the United States. Mexico, they do better. Canada, they do better. But if fuel prices go up, you know, people will be moving to Chevy dealers pretty quickly.
The other thing, too, is if you look at the vehicles that have come out of GM DAT, Daewoo Automotive Technologies, they're pretty damn good. I think the Aveo is probably, you know, not gone through that cycle of good stuff coming out of GM DAT. I think it was, you know, out so long ago, it was before they really got their mojo going in that place.
It quietly is one of the stars over at General Motors. It really is.
Except they're not making money.
Well, GM debt?
Yeah.
Well, one of the problems is the Yuan has gone against their favor. So,
I mean, how do Hyundai and Kia do it?
Why? But they've co-located a lot of production in other parts of the world, too.
Oh, well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Hyundai is building a lot of cars here now.
So. And they took that strategy
from the larger
Japanese
scale, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we got another phoner here.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan Brown out in Old Van, New Jersey.
All right, Jonathan.
Happy holidays. Great show. What do you think the chances are? 50-50, 60-40? 90-10, 10-90, that Hyundai will drop the 5-liter, 429-horsepower V8 in a killer Genesis coupe. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening.
I think as Hyundai progresses, they are going to start investigating niches that they haven't addressed, and I could see that happening.
It's a similar engine box to the sedan, so you can do it. I'm sure there'd be some packaging issues, but you can do it. The bonnet comes down a little bit more quickly.
I wouldn't be surprised if they've already done it and it's running around the proving ground
someplace.
I'm sure
some executive is having
fun with
it all day.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a mid-engine two-seat prototype running around for about 2015 to, you know, show up at a concept as a concept in some, like the Paris show or something totally unexpected and... I wouldn't put it past
them. I wouldn't put it past them at all, right.
Because they've got hot designers. They're starting to get the technology, you know.
Okay, here's another question. Rumblestrip asks, what's the panel's take on Ford hiring the designer from Cadillac for the Lincoln brand?
I think it's a huge, huge move. I think it's great for that design, particular designer. But it's also a signal by Ford that they are dead serious about what they're doing with Lincoln.
They have to be, actually.
Yeah.
I think, especially to make it global.
Yeah.
To make it global, you're going to have to broaden the taste and the design of that.
Well, we've talked about this. In fact, Peter and I have talked about it a lot. You know, what do you do? and I'm sure this is the raging debate in Ford, do you just say, hey, let's make it a good brand in the American market, let's go back to making some money on it, or do you say, no, let's go right after Lexus?
Well, they're all off existing Ford platforms, so it makes a lot of sense to basically almost like properly done Acura off of Hondas in some respects. But if you think about it, what's that first project that that person's going to work on? Probably the Lincoln C-Car. That's probably going to be a key project that they're still going to be able to have is somewhat malleable now. So,
if they're going to make the kind of investment they're making in Lincoln, yeah, eventually there'll be a global component to it. There has to be.
Yeah.
And there's one market in particular, China.
Yeah. Bingo. Great point. Okay, back to the questions. Dale Leonard asks, is Ford going to phase out the Flex? I never see any advertising anywhere for it anymore.
They don't advertise it. That vehicle has tremendous word of mouth for the people who own them. They talk them up all the time, but I don't know what they're going to do with it.
Sales haven't been that good.
No.
But they're not that good.
When you get in one, and particularly the EcoBoost and everything, it's a great driving vehicle. So
the problem they're going to run into, though, is if you look at the new Explorer, it's seven seats. It's a Ford. It's sold at the same dealer. And now you got another seven-seat vehicle right next to it. I think it's going to be a little problematic to sell Flex up against Explorer over an extended period of time.
Yeah, so we could see them.
I just got a chance to drive the Flex with the 3.5-liter EcoBoost. Wow.
It moves.
It transforms that vehicle.
Yeah, it moves.
And one other interesting thing, too, they've got I think it's called the Platinum Edition.
Oh, that's great.
And they put the letters Flex on the leading edge of the hood, much like the Land Rover does, you know, with the Range Rover.
Much like the Raptor pickup truck, too, by the way.
Well, you don't confuse this with the Raptor.
No, but...
But
you know,
because when I first saw that Platinum Edition with the big Flex letters on the front of the hood, I went, oh, my God, that is so Range Rover.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and they went, oh, really? We hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure you didn't. Yeah, I'm sure you didn't.
Pedro Craig wants to know, does anybody know if GM is working on a V6 motor that will compete or trump Ford's 3.7-liter V6 in their pickups? Because the 4.3 V6 seems to be dated.
Yeah, that Vortec 4.3 is old, and it is eventually going away. They are looking at the problem has always been torque. If you're in the mid threes, you got to find enough torque to put it into a pickup truck.
When I was down at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the announcement of Chevy coming back into IndyCar, Tom Stevens made a very interesting comment because I asked him, I said, okay, you're building this motor. Are we going to see this motor or something very similar in production? He said, yes.
Oh.
We're working on it.
Oh, my God.
You can bet we're going to make sure that this production-based technology ends up in our production cars. So that's a 2.4-liter twin-turbo V6.
Yeah. See, the Colorado's going away, so they're going to have to fill all that pickup truck gap with a full-size. To get that, you're going to have to go down displacement to get better fuel economy. They're going to have to do it.
Or you're going to see that 2.4-liter twin-turbo show up in a special Camaro.
Right.
And so there's all kinds of possibilities for that.
Let's take some more here. Legislative Geek asks, what's the real percentage of CO2 put out in the U.S. by cars compared to power plants? I don't know the figure for power plants. I do know the figure for light vehicles, which would include passenger cars, pickups, SUVs, and all that stuff. In the United States, it's 18% of all CO2. That's 1/8% comes from pass cars and light trucks. I don't know what it is for power plants. But it's, to me, ridiculous that the automobile is singled out for so much attention on cutting CO2 when it's 18% of the problem. Ergo, we're ignoring the other 82%. So you're never going to get anywhere by just piling it on with the automobile.
I think emissions has always been a proxy for, obviously, better fuel economy, too. I think that's one of the kind of the other aims. Folks in Washington are usually not that smart. But usually, obviously, lower emissions, lower fuel, or better fuel economy.
And I should say, that's 18% in the United States. If I remember the numbers off the top of my head now, it's like 11% on a global basis. Mm-hmm. Automobiles and light vehicles. We're not talking trains and ships and all other forms of transportation. They account for 11%. Steve asks, do you think any automaker will ever offer an autonomous vehicle? Seems impossible without the manufacturers insuring the cars themselves. I tell you, I am so...
I know you've got a great opinion.
I'm gung-ho, man. I am gung-ho on autonomous vehicles.
I saw you at OESA talking about it, so...
I'm telling you, 10 years. 10 years. That's my prediction.
Well, the most advanced urban centers in the globe will have some sort of, you know, guidance thing. And John and I have already discussed this. That's when I'm going off the grid.
I thought it was. I know that when you and Jim were doing that tag team, and Jim brought up the example of, you know, what do you need glass for when you've got cameras? You put cameras outside your vehicle, and you can have flat panels inside. You can see whatever you want to see by just looking at the flat panel. And earlier to your earlier comment, glass is heavy. Metal's not as heavy as glass when it covers the same area.
And I know what Jim Hall was saying on that, but I still think people like windows. And I still love the story of when NASA designed the space lab, you know.
Didn't put a window in it at first.
And they invited Raymond Loewy. And you guys should know who Raymond Loewy is. He did all the design for Studebakers. He did a whole bunch of other design stuff, too. He did the Avanti. He designed all kinds of stuff. Anyway, long story short, NASA invites him in to look at how they've designed this space module where astronauts are going to live. Remember, this is back, what, mid-1970s? And he goes, where's the window? And they said, what window? He says, you're going to put these guys up in a can in space and not let them look out a window? So they put in a window. And he said he was so rewarded afterwards when all the astronauts told him, thank God that window was there. Every spare second I had, I was just glued to that window, looking out into, looking at Earth and looking at space. Yep. So. Oh, we've got one more call that just came in. Ben, let's bring in the one from Sarasota.
Hi, it's Phil Kay from Sarasota, John. Been a fan for quite a while, and I'd like to, you know, learn more about your life and, you know, what your history is. In addition to that, can you tell me why the Northern Police don't use all-wheel drive cars, and what do they use to beat the problem of snow and ice? That would be interesting for us people who... have lived up there to learn. Thank you.
Sure thing. Well, we'll have to get into my history sometime. But
I think there should be a biography special on you.
Yeah.
we'll call A&E.
And then in the third grade.
We hear about all your old girlfriends. Oh, that'd be awesome.
No, we're not going to go there. but that's a great question about all-wheel drive. I suspect because the police cars that have been available, I don't even think it's money, Michael. Think about it. Crown Vic never had all-wheel drive. Well, Chevy Impala doesn't have all-wheel drive.
Vehicles that they used never had all-wheel drive, I agree.
Right. Yeah. Now, they're...
Chargers.
But the Charger, you can get all-wheel
drive.
The
Taurus, you can get all-wheel drive,
Now, too. The Taurus, you can, right.
But the Michigan State Police didn't order their Chargers with...
all-wheel drive, huh?
Because they had Tahoes. They had police Tahoes.
But I think you got a point. It adds, what, at least $1,000 to the
Try
purchase.
Repairing those things.
And repair,
it's
right.
One thing. I mean, they're driving over curbs and everything else. Yeah. Can you imagine the repair costs?
That's why they don't want to do it.
But I'll tell you one thing, too, which makes a huge difference. You put snow tires on a car, it transforms it.
Modern-day snow tires on all four corners of a rear-wheel drive car, you can do whatever you want to do.
I've always said, if I had to choose between... driving in the snow, if I had to choose between all-wheel drive and snow tires, I'll take snow tires every day.
My brother lives in Barrie, Ontario, and he's got Bredesteins on his car, and you can drive that thing anywhere you want. I mean, they are fantastic tires.
And you combine snow tires with traction control and ABS.
Can't beat it.
And you'd be surprised at how well you can get even a rear drive car to go through the snow. And remember, we all grew up with rear drive.
Yeah. Yep. Plus, and for grins, turn that traction control off and hang that mother out.
Oh, yeah. Look, I've always
That's how you learn how to drive up north here.
That's right. It's the only time when there's snow on the ground that you can absolutely drive 10 tenths every turn, every corner, and only be going about 35 miles an hour and absolutely be on the ragged edge and not know if you're going
to
crash.
I used to take my sister's Camaro out when I was 14 when there was a fresh snowfall. Which, of course, she didn't know I was doing this, but I would take it out, and that's how I learned how to drive. I'd slide through the neighborhood. Just correcting the slides. So this is awesome, you know?
I learned how to do handbrake turns in the snow because it's easy to learn that way.
Yeah.
And that gets to be fun.
Oh, yeah.
And especially when the snow melts, and then you learn how to do it when there's no snow and ice on the ground. That's when it really gets fun to do handbrake turns.
That's one of the benefits of living up north, eh?
Yep, no doubt.
Yeah, right. Well, look, we ought to wrap up here. It's time to do that. Want to thank all our sponsors. And, you know, when we talked about some of the things, I forgot to mention a couple of websites. You want to learn more about Dow's structural foam? Go to dowbetamate.com. And if you want to learn more about the sixth generation Sonata, go to HyundaiSonata.com. And again, if you can't remember the URLs, just go to our Autoline website and click on the logo. Remember, you can friend us at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit, Twitter us, twitter.com/Autoline. Go read Peter's stuff. Do it right now at AutoExtremist.com. Follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. Michael, you got anything to...
Oh, we're at IHS.com somewhere. I'm sure we're somewhere in there.
Well, anyway, remember you can get our stuff here on Stitcher. It'll go on your BlackBerry, your smartphones. Just go to our website and find it there. But Michael Robinet, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Jeff.
Great
thanks
having you
Peter.
On here. And Peter, man, it's great to be back in the studio with you.
Yeah, it's good, Jim.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at dowbetamate.com. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at hyundaisonata.com.